Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Williams. It's UPR Spring Member Drive, and on Access Utah, that means some very special programming, including some best of segments from favorite episodes and some great new conversations. And today, our guest for the hour is writer and photographer Stephen Trimble. And we're going to talk about some of his recent pieces in various publications titled variously, Facebook, Alas, is Not Your Neighborhood Bar, Restore Utah's National Monuments and Make the Fix Permanent, Utah in 125 Words, and Big Books at Big Times, Expanded New Edition. As a writer, editor, and photographer, Stephen Trimble has published 25 award-winning books during 45 years of paying attention to the landscapes and peoples of the Desert West. His most recent book is The Capitol Reef Reader, and he makes his home in Salt Lake City in the Red Rock country of Torrey, Utah. You can find him at stephentrimble.net. So, Stephen Trimble, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thanks for that lovely introduction.
Well, thanks for sending these pieces over. And as I mentioned, sometimes during this time of year, we do some best of segments, but these are very interesting pieces. And so I've just jettisoned the best of. We'll have all new conversation today. So thanks for that. I found this. This is just kind of a little teeny description of yourself on medium.com. You say, gotta write. If not, I get depressed. Photography brings me great joy, but writing takes everything I've got. So that's that kind of indicates the, I don't know, the pressures of both of those. Kind of you've been in both of those worlds.
Yeah, I've been in both of those worlds my whole professional lifetime. Many people have asked me whether I prefer writing or photography. And I'm not really begging the question when I say that I love them both dearly and could never choose. Photography is an emotional experience, really, where you're, responding to the world as this wonderful array of graphics and color and the decisive moment of light. And you take the picture and you've got it or you don't have it. And I suppose in these days you could also add that chapter of fiddling around in Photoshop, but I still think a little bit like an old-fashioned photographer who was trying to capture it in that one decisive moment on film, and then you either have it or you don't. Writing is so different because you take notes in your journal and you do research and you interview people, and then you try to put it all together into something coherent, and your first draft is terrible. And you keep working, and you rewrite, and you rewrite. And even when it's published, you could still go back and make it better. So it really does take everything you've got.
By the way, do you have Utah in 125 Words? Do you have that in front of you?
I do.
So I wonder, I'd love to have you. You wrote four pieces. I guess this was solicited for a collection. That I can't remember who was doing this. And you sent them
four pieces.
Yeah, so
it was the Utah Department of, I always forget these complicated names. It was basically the Utah State Government, Utah State Heritage Agency. And they were celebrating, or they are celebrating, the 125th anniversary of statehood. And Ellen Wiest, a fine editor, was running this little project for them, inviting writers to submit 125-word stories about Utah, obviously 125 words, 125 years. And I submitted several to Ellen. She ran only one on the website, but I liked all the little stories that I put together, so I also posted them on Medium myself.
Yeah, you sent four and she chose one, but we'd love to hear all of them interspersed throughout the program. I wonder if you could read the first one for us right now.
Okay, sure. I'd be delighted. So each of these, most of these came from seeds of writing in my published work, and I would go back to a scene that I particularly loved and boil it down to exactly 125 words. A couple of them are new, but I gave Ellen several choices knowing that she would have a mix of locations around the state, different kinds of voices. I knew that she might like one or two of them equally, but there would be one that would fit. And so I gave her a couple on the Wasatch and a couple on southern Utah. And I will start with a vignette, excuse me, about the Wasatch that I called A Chorus of Mountains. The spine of the Wasatch Range swings from one mountain to the next in graceful curves, a loose aggregation of mountain blocks, each sliced off in facets by faults and isolated as massifs by canyons and rivers. Clusters of peaks stand as small choruses, soloists, trios, sometimes a half dozen peaks rounding behind a valley. You pass into the mountains with a single exhilarating footstep, sagebrush to forest, water to rock, basin to range, valley to peak. In this uniquely Western geography, public land and designated wilderness lie literally just over the backyard fence. Once you take that stride, you enter a zone of unpredictability. You leave the familiar, safe cocoons of car, house, office, and give yourself to the intimate potency of the mountains.
It's A Chorus of Mountains, 125 words. So you pass into the mountains with a single exhilarating footstep. That's, I think, one of the joys of living in this place, isn't it? These places in the West.
We are so lucky to live in the West. We get complacent about public land and complacent about this wild country right next to our cities. Now, there are other cities in the West that have this. Albuquerque and Phoenix and Tucson occur to me. But, boy, I've done field work doing interviews in the East where I'm trying to find little places to camp out of my car at night. And there's no public land. You know, you end up getting kind of desperate and looking for church parking lots or construction sites. You know, it's quite different from here in the West where we have all this glorious country that belongs to us all to explore, to camp in, to learn from.
We'll get into talking about public lands later in the hour. You wrote an op-ed piece, I think this is for the LA Times, right, about national monuments in Utah. I want to turn next to something you wrote for Medium, I think it's for Medium.com. It's called Big Books at Big Times, Expanded New Edition, 3 exclamation points. You're going for an advertisement kind of vibe there, maybe. And you talk about some books that have had a big effect on your life at you know, milestones, mileposts in your life. I wonder if you'd maybe, so you'd start with David Copperfield. And this was age, what, 21?
Yes. That's right. Yeah, this was sort of triggered by watching the new film of David Copperfield a few weeks ago, The Personal History of David Copperfield with Dev Patel playing David Copperfield. And the movie is great fun. It's not a masterpiece, but it's definitely entertaining on our quarantine nights. But it reminded me how much David Copperfield meant to me when I was 21. And I had thought about this before in a piece that I read on the KUER NPR station back in 2000 when I turned 50. And I still had that piece on my laptop. The piece occurred to me originally when I was turning 50 and realized I'm reading another big book. And I realized that my own personal journey, my own personal therapy, however, my emotional evolution as an adult, is often tied to retreating into books at difficult times or at big times. And so I remembered back to when I was 21 and finished with college and kind of lonesome and waiting for the next thing to happen. And I remember spending hours and hours and hours sprawled in my thrift store easy chair in the room that I was renting from friends, just disappearing into David Copperfield and weeping over it. And, you know, looking around at all my friends who were finding love, and I was lonesome and alone, and it was a big deal for me. It was just an important book to kind of bring me back into the world of, you know, relationships. And that happened again in my late 20s and early 30s when I was also sort of emotionally miserable and decided, I know what I need to do. I need to sit in the sun outside of the little apartment I was living in Flagstaff, Arizona, and read War and Peace, and started in on all 1,455 pages and kept going. You know, I'd always heard it was the best novel ever written, and it's pretty wonderful. And again, it at times like that, these books just take you out of yourself. And so War and Peace had that same heft for me, and I've kept those two battered paperbacks with me all these years just because they were so important to me.
You have photographs then, of them in
at
this
the time
piece.
Go ahead.
I was going to say you have photographs of these, the actual books. They look a little worn, but they look loved.
Exactly. And it was actually great fun to find them on the bookshelf and photograph them for this recent piece. And so when I was 50, I realized I wasn't miserable. I was actually quite happy with my family living in Salt Lake. But I realized that I was also reading another big book, a contemporary novel by Mark Helprin called The Soldier of the Great War, a wonderful book. And I finished that little radio essay that I read all those years ago, talking about what I was learning from the main character in this other very long novel. And so thinking back to all that and having this movie about David Copperfield triggering those memories, I realized, well, by God, I've turned 70 this year, which is an astonishing fact. And what am I reading? Well, in the quarantine, we're all reading big books because we have time to read big books, and realized that I'm reading quite a different book right now. It's a science fiction book about the very near future called The Ministry for the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson. And it's another 563 pages to disappear into. The author calls it a baggy monster because he's crammed so much in there. It's really an interesting book about what will happen as we experience climate change in the next 30 or 40 years. And the Ministry for the Future is a United Nations ministry that's charged with advocating. And it's a wild book. He envisions some terrible things, but also some really clever solutions to what we're facing. And so I realized I'm looking to the future now. I'm really not so much concerned about my own emotional journey as being concerned about what the world will be like for my children in 30 years. And so I finished up a sort of epilogue to my big books at big times, which is why I played around with that newspaper headline, by writing about my current big book.
Is there a running theme through all of these books? You know, each of them is big, sprawling, you know, adventures. Seems like
I think the theme. I think the theme for me is simply, you know, finding inspiration and healing in literature, and finding you know, emotional connection. In those early days, I was finding emotional connection through the characters in literature when I wasn't finding it so much in the real world. I got better at that as I aged, as we all hope to do. But you know, as a writer, I guess, and as a reader, ever since I was a kid, I've always found books to be my friends. And that may sound a little hokey and trite, but you know, books are really dependable. And you can go back to them. They teach and they challenge and they console and they heal. And that's definitely the theme here. Is when I need ideas and I need healing and I need just about anything that I might not be able to get from the people around me, that's all there waiting on bookshelves and in libraries. And these days, of course, on our devices as well. It's a incredible world that we are just so lucky to have.
You mentioned in this piece that early on, I guess the first couple of books, you didn't tend to underline. Then you started underlining later on. Why is that?
Well, I think that's partly evidence of becoming a writer. I was starting out in the early days just simply as a reader. And as time went on, I realized when I would read something that was just a great line, I might be able to use that as the seed for an essay. I might be able to use that as a quote. I want to find it again. So I'd underline a paragraph or put a line next to a paragraph or put a star on the top of the page so I could flip through the book and find it. And those single line quotes often will turn up in my own writing. Every writer does that, I think. It's a little bit like the old Victorian commonplace book where you would actually copy out passages that you loved. And by recopying, you hear it differently, you hear it in your brain, you remember it better. It's a little bit like redrawing maps. I always have felt very strongly that when I need a map for a book of mine, the best thing I can do is draw it myself in sort of a crude way that I will pass on to a map maker. And it helps me a lot understand the lay of the land.
These photographs illustrate that at least early on, you obviously, as we all were, are reading physical copies of the books. These are well-used books. Have you moved on to electronic reading now?
I will read on my Kindle or my iPad, and I do that all the time. But I miss the physical object when I do that. You know, you miss one of the grand things about books is book design, covers. There's so many decisions that a book designer makes to design a single page. The choice of type, the space of the words and the lines and the margins and where the photographs go. I love book design, and so I miss that desperately when I'm reading on my iPad or my Kindle. And there's a physicality that I think brings those words into your brain a little bit differently when you're actually holding the physical object. You want your memory to work in several different ways, and the tactile feel of a book in your hands is quite different from holding an iPad in your hands. The other thing I find with a lot of my friends, nobody remembers titles or authors' names anymore, because once you get into the Kindle, that you don't see that. With a physical book, every time you pick up the book, there's the cover, there's the title, there's the author's name. And, as a writer, I hope people will remember the name of things that I write. And I certainly pay a lot of attention to the names of writers whose work I read.
Mm. When you're out in, some of your favorite country, I can imagine maybe you have your camera. Do you have a book with you as well, or a notebook? What do you take out there?
All of the above. There's a great joy in reading books about the place that you're in. I know some people avoid this, and some writers avoid reading the other writers who have written about the place they're in, but I love to do that. When I'm traveling, I'll try to find, the one book that really ties me to the place and teaches me about a place I may know nothing about. If you're going to run the Green River, it's great to have Ellen Molloy's book, Raven's Exile, with you to read on the river. If you're traveling in the canyon country for the first time, you got to start with Desert Solitaire, Ed Abbey's book. And, those kinds of ties to the voice of the land, I just love. And sometimes the book is more informational. I traveled in Laos and Cambodia just before we all moved into our bedrooms for the pandemic and found a wonderful book about the Mekong River that told me all kinds of things I did not know about how the Mekong ties together those countries of Southeast Asia. So absolutely, I always have books with me, and sometimes it may just be a novel that I pour myself into rather than one of these more informational books. In terms of my journals, I'm fond of those blue, I don't know what to call them. They're basically blue books that you would use in a lab in college. That I usually find them in college bookstores, and they have a hardback and they have numbered pages, and that's what I use for my journals to write down my own thoughts and observations and sensory impressions of places. And I have a whole stack of those now, and actually donated them along with the rest of my archives to the Marriott Library up at the University of Utah. So when I need to look something up, I have to go up there myself and find it. And each time I finish a journal, I number it. I do a really rough table of contents on my laptop, page by page, just tied to, here's what I wrote, on this date when I visited the Black Rock Desert in Nevada. Or here's what I wrote when I interviewed one of the great Pueblo potters in New Mexico on this particular date. And it may just be a name and a place, but I can then use my search command in my index to all my journals to find my way back to page 34, journal 3, 1995, and, you know, get right back to that quote that I'm looking for. So it's been super useful for me as a writer to do that.
Well, you conclude this this piece on, you know, Milepost Books. You say, when I turn 90, and yet another big moment, I'm looking forward to yet another big book. Check back in 20 years for my update. So we'll...
That's right.
We'll do that. Very good. And I guess you probably no idea at all what you'll pick up at age 90, right? Maybe it hasn't been written.
No idea. That's right. It hasn't been written. I hope I'm alive. I hope the earth is in good enough shape to provide me with that book.
Yeah. Well, if you just joined us, we're talking with writer and photographer Stephen Trimble on the program today. We'll do a pause before we go to break. To take care of business with our member drive. And so if you support conversations like this with interesting folks like Stephen Trimble, we hope that you will become a member of Utah Public Radio. Just whatever amount that is comfortable for you, we'll be happy with that, and you'll help us toward our overall goal. A couple of ways you can do that. You can go to upr.org. upr.org is our website, and you can look at all of our thank you gifts there, including our latest UPR art mug, 2021. Add that to your collection for a pledge of $8 a month, upr.org. Or if it's 9 o'clock in the morning, the 9 o'clock hour, you can call 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495. So Stephen Trimble, we'll enlist you in this. What? Why should folks become members of their public radio station?
Well, if you're listening right now, you care about National Public Radio. You care about Utah Public Radio. And it's not just a matter of caring. I mean, the voices that we hear over the radio become our friends. You know, folks have been listening to you, Tom, for years. And all those hosts of the big national programs, All Things Considered, Morning Edition, all the others, Terry Gross, you know, we've been listening to them for years. And they connect us to the world. National Public Radio connects us to the world. And, you know, I love the serendipity of hearing friends tell me, oh, yeah, I turned on the radio in the morning and sat down to drink my coffee, and there you were, talking to Tom Williams on Access Utah. What a kick. So, you know, that's great fun for me to hear that. But it's even more crucial for all of us to know that we can depend on all the important stories, all the stories we'd never know about in any other way, coming to us so easily. We just turn on the radio, whether it's on our phones or in our car or at home, and there it is, and we didn't pay for it unless we become a supporting member. And it's really just a part of being a good citizen, of being a part of our community, to make that contribution, to make that donation.
And here's how you make that happen. It's a couple of different ways. UPR.org. UPR.org is our website. And you can just click on the front page there. There's a pledge button. Click on that. Bring up a pledge form. You fill out some basic information. And off you go. Takes a couple of minutes. UPR.org. And we thank you in advance. Or if it's 9 o'clock in the morning, and I keep time shifting there because you definitely want you to call during the morning, but we do have an evening broadcast. So if it's 7 o'clock, just go to upr.org. But in the morning, you can call 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495. I'll say it once again, 800-826-1495. And we're thanking you in advance. We do need your support to keep us on track with the pledge drive. You are the single most important source of funding to UPR, and we do appreciate it. UPR.org or 800-826-1495. We'll take a break. Be back.
What is climate change? How is it affecting our lives? And what can we do about it? We'll connect the dots from energy to extreme weather, public health, the economy, agriculture, and more. Catch Climate Connections weekday mornings at 5:49 and 8:49 on Morning Edition, and afternoons at 3:48 during All Things Considered, here on Utah Public Radio.
For the past 2 years here on Utah Public Radio, we've been bringing you a weekly dose of research and exploration. We call it Undisciplined because we work really hard to take scientific studies, which are usually written in journals intended for people who share a background in a subject matter, and make them accessible for just about everyone. There are more than 100 episodes available wherever you get your podcasts, or you can catch us every Thursday morning at 10:30 here on UPR.
Thanks for joining us for Access U Time. Tom Williams and my guest for the hour is writer and photographer Stephen Trimble. You can find him at stephentrimble.net. His most recent book is The Capitol Reef Reader. Lives in Salt Lake City and in Torrey, Utah, in Wayne County. We are spending the hour with him. We do a kind of variety of things during the member drive on Access Utah. Sometimes we pull out the best of Access Utah segments. Stephen Trimble has been writing some very interesting things lately, and so we're spending our time with those. So it's all new conversation today, all in support of our member drive. And here are the ways you can become a member of Utah Public Radio or renew your membership. UPR.org. UPR.org is our website, or you can call 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495. We have some great thank you gifts as well. One that I'll mention specifically, our new UPR art mug. We had an art contest, and the winner is Carol Bold from Southern Utah, and her design is beautiful, Red Rock Country. And on the side it says Utah Public Radio 2021. This is the latest in that art mug collection, and you don't want to have a gap in your mug collection from UPR. So $8 a month is all it will take to get you that mug. UPR.org, UPR.org, or 800-826-1495. 800-826-1495. Stephen Trimble, I wonder if you could read for us another of these Utah in 125 words pieces.
I'd be delighted. Let me read you one from Southern Utah. I'm talking to you from Torrey, and this is called Spring Canyon Sunshower, and I'm looking out my window toward the big red cliffs over near Capitol Reef, which is exactly where this takes place. In Spring Canyon, a nine-mile wander through the water pocket fold, slick rock surrounds us as we thread the cliffs. We lose ourselves in the spring water surprise of a pool reflecting golden stone. Benign clouds sail across the blue stripe of sky, framed by canyon walls. 7 miles in, thunder rolls down canyon. Raindrops fall one by one, increasing to a scatter, a sprinkle, each drop diving through the oven of summer air held between the desert-varnished walls. Though the clouds have turned moody, they haven't filled the sky. They're erratic here and there. And so our rain shower is also a sun shower. Thrilled, we look up between sandstone towers into a brilliantly backlit sky, following each raindrop, sunstruck, gleaming, jewel-like, as it falls from sky to canyon floor.
Beautiful.
So that was another 125-word story.
Yes.
No extra words allowed.
That's right, 125 words. You can pack a lot in, though, 125 words. So this is beautiful country. I love Capitol Reef country. Obviously, you do as well. You live at least part of the time there. So during the height of the pandemic, I think you mentioned that you went to Torrey. I don't know how much time in normal times you spent between the two places, Torrey and Salt Lake City, but you went to Torrey.
Yeah, excuse me. Absolutely, we did. I was a seasonal ranger here at Capitol Reef 45 years ago, which is a shock, and have been coming back ever since. And for nearly 20 years, my family has had a place just outside of Torrey, very close to the park. And we had never spent more than about 10 days in a row here, you know, between jobs and kids and commitments in Salt Lake. 10 days was a total luxury. But when the pandemic hit, my wife and I decided that we could be here. You know, whatever work we needed to do, we could do remotely. We now have internet at the house. And so we moved down just about a year ago, actually on the day of the earthquake in Salt Lake City. And I've lived here more or less full time for a year, with occasional trips back to Salt Lake to resupply and see our family. And it's been a great privilege. It's really been a gift. As older folks who had this opportunity, we were not essential workers. We were not working on the front line of healthcare. We had it really easy. So we could isolate here in a relatively safe place. And we kind of hiked our way through the seasons here and visited all kinds of little nooks and crannies we didn't know about. And although I'm acutely aware of our privilege, it's really been just a delight. And it's actually also given me a new understanding of living in rural Utah. And I've been writing about the tensions between urban living and urban visitors and pilgrims to the public land, the tensions between those folks and the people that live in these small towns scattered through the canyon country full time. I've been writing about that my whole career. But I never lived full time myself in rural Utah until now. And Salt Lake City feels like a very long ways away. And when we go back, it's congested and busy and kind of discombobulating. And so I've learned a lot from this experience.
Did you change any opinions or have any shifts in focus and on some of these issues that, that you've been writing about for a long time?
I don't think I changed my opinions. I still believe that public lands belong to everyone, and that, you know, although here is a local a person living locally, I have incredible access. You know, yesterday my wife and I took a hike on the Chimney Rock Trail in Capitol Reef and ran into a family visiting from Wisconsin on spring break. And they, you know, their feeling for that place was just as strong as ours. It was brand new to them. They were blown away. And that place belongs to them, just as it does to me. And the local county commissioners are not the people with the authority over how that land is managed. That land needs to be managed for all of us. And so, if anything, I might feel even more strongly about the value of public lands.
Well, we've now made, a very good segue into your piece that you had recently on the Utah's national monuments. In this piece, very interesting, you give kind of a background, of course, right? Grand Staircase, Escalante, and Bears Ears. Bears Ears was reduced by President Trump, I don't know, some 70% or something. Grand Staircase cut in half or something.
85%.
85%.
Yeah, 85%.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in this piece, you talk about how this theme of local versus national has, I mean, it runs deep. You cite Governor Clyde back in, the 1960s. He's been putting forward some of these arguments that you hear today, that you hear today from most of Utah's elected officials, we ought to have local control.
Yes, Tom. Again, this is a theme I've written about a lot. We are at a really interesting moment in the history of conservation of the West right now. Trump, the former president, did something no one else had ever done and went back to reverse some of the grand successes of conservation in the last generation, going back to Grand Staircase and cutting it in half and eliminating half of the monument from protective boundaries. And going back to the brand new Bears Ears before we even had a master plan for Bears Ears, and virtually wiping it out, taking away 85% of the monument from those boundaries that protect the monument and allow for increased funding and increased research and, you know, literally research that can't be funded and completed outside of a national monument. The national monument designation allows a research paleontologist or a research archaeologist access to funding that they just don't have on other public lands. So the boundaries make a lot of difference. And as a conservationist who, you know, participated in the fight for both of those national monuments, I was terribly outraged and wounded by the former president's actions. And so now I'm doing my best to contribute what I can to the fight to restore them. And in this op-ed, I was responding to the statements from our congressional delegation, insisting that they be consulted and part of the decision-making process as the Biden administration contemplates what to do next, what to do about bringing back our national monuments. And the point I make is that the congressional delegation doesn't really have standing. They have said so many things over the years that are evidence that they really don't support the idea of public lands belonging to everyone. They don't support the management of these public lands for all Americans. They are really determined to transfer management and control over Utah's public lands to the most local elected authorities that they can. And I believe that's absolutely the wrong thing to do. And so the point of my op-ed in the Los Angeles Times was the Biden administration can talk to them, but their opinion is not particularly useful because we know what they're going to say. They're going to say, these are Utah's lands. We need control. And it's simply not true. The lands were never Utah's land. The lands were indigenous homelands to start and then claimed by Spain and Mexico in turn. And when the United States government essentially stole those lands from indigenous people and the government of Mexico, in the latter being in the Mexican War in 1847, you know, the lands have been federal lands, United States public lands ever since. And, you know, when Utah became a state, the federal government gave Utah school trust lands, the remainder of which are now managed by CITLA, but the rest of the state never belonged to the state. And what we have now as BLM land and national parks and national forests, those are all the lands that weren't homesteaded. They were offered up as homesteads back in the late 1800s and early 1900s, and the land that where you couldn't make a living, the leftover lands became Bureau of Land Management land. And they're remarkable places and refuges of wildness and incredibly important to science and to climate change. You know, a place like Grand Staircase, a big preserve like that, can serve as an ark for species that are going to wink out and go extinct elsewhere. And in that more untouched, wilder place, they may make it. And we may need those kinds of places. You know, certainly the Biden administration is well aware of that and thinking about this project they're calling 30 by 30, preserving 30% of the nation as protected wild lands by 2030. And Utah's going to be a very big part of that because we have such remarkable landscapes. If we restore Grand Staircase and Bears Ears, we will have protected a continuous stretch of country all the way from Bryce Canyon to Moab. And that's absolutely remarkable and incredibly important to building resilience in the face of climate change, and totally appropriate because it just so happens that the boundaries of Utah contain the very heart of the Colorado Plateau, land that is just unlike anywhere else.
I want to have you respond to an argument you put forward from Congressman Stewart in your article. You note that Congressman Chris Stewart is your congressman. Grand Staircase lies within his district. So you, for part of this op-ed, you focus on Grand Staircase. So I just quote this you in a paragraph from your op-ed. In a debate last fall, Stewart proclaimed, "The presumption of many is that the people of Utah are just too stupid or too ill-willed to manage their lands." So you go on to say, his much-criticized bill to create an Escalante Canyons National Park from fragments of the diminished Trump monument would grant local county commissioners management of federal lands. So why shouldn't county commissioners manage these lands?
Well, county commissioners are not scientists. They're not land managers. They care primarily in many of the rural counties in southern Utah, not everyone, but in many of them, they care primarily about a sort of an imagined return to boom times driven by extractive industry. And Sure, there were booms in terms of mining and logging in the old days, but you know, we live in a new world now, and those boom times, if they did return, they would be brief and they would be dangerous and damaging to the land. And I just don't think that elected politicians typically don't take the long view. You know, there's certainly exceptions. You know, San Juan County now has two Navajo commissioners on a three commissioner board, and those members of the county commission in San Juan County who are members of the Navajo Nation are going to take a very different view of these kinds of things, and indeed they support the restoration of Bears Ears. But that's not certainly not true in Garfield County. So I want to make sure that science is the bulwark of how we make our decisions about these places. You know, Bears Ears is the most important unprotected archaeological resource in North America, unprotected as it is now. We did a whole lot better back in the in that brief moment when Obama set aside 1.5 million acres. Grand Staircase is the most important place in the world to study Cretaceous dinosaurs. There's no other set of formations quite like what you see along the southern rim of the Kaparowitz Plateau. We haven't even investigated most of what's at Grand Staircase in terms of paleontology and archaeology. The diversity of soils at Grand Staircase give ecologists and soil scientists and botanists unbelievable opportunities to do research. And if you take away the prohibition on ATVs going anywhere they wish, that research becomes impossible, and we lose the opportunity to learn things that we'll never have the chance to learn again. And so I want to make sure that, and I want to do my best to make sure that the decisions we make about those places are based on what the people with the biggest vision have. And you know, science and looking forward is way more important than, you know, preserving a tiny number of people with permits to graze cows in those places, which is not an important economic contribution even today to those counties. You know, Garfield County and Kane counties, the two counties that Grand Staircase covers, value, as they should, value the culture of ranching. It's part of the history of the place. But it certainly is not the bedrock of their economy anymore. It's just a tiny, tiny fraction of the economy, which now depends on travel and tourism and recreation and retirees.
Well, if you just joined us, we're talking with Stephen Trimble. He's a writer and photographer. And we, right there, we're talking about his op-ed piece, talking about national monuments in Utah. I want to take another break, and when we come back, I want to close with the discussion we were having yesterday, and this will be a continuation of that discussion, which is how do we talk to each other? How do we engage when the divide gets bigger and bigger? And so Stephen Trimble had an op-ed recently in the Salt Lake Tribune titled "Facebook, Alas, is Not Your Neighborhood Bar." But before we go to break, just want to remind you, it's the Member Drive on Utah Public Radio, Spring Member Drive. That's your opportunity to tell us, hey, I like this, I don't like this. Your comments are very, very important. And even more importantly, here's your opportunity to support programming like Access Utah. 800-826-1495 is the phone number, and if you're looking at the clock and it's in the 9 o'clock hour in the morning, do indeed call that, 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495. Anytime, you can go to our website, upr.org, upr.org, and make your pledge there. You are very, very important. We have various sources of funding, but increasingly important is the funding that comes directly from you. And so we do rely on that, and I thank you in advance for your support. Stephen Trimble, maybe another appeal to your fellow listeners, fellow members. Why should we support UPR?
Well, think about how important UPR and public radio has been during the pandemic. You know, we've all been isolated for a year in one way or another, some really isolated, some people being super careful and hardly going out of their homes. Other people had to go out and work and take the risks that they needed to take to make sure they had a paycheck and keep groceries being delivered to the rest of us and keep health care being delivered. But through all of that, public radio just kept going, providing us the stories and the facts and the research and the voice of Anthony Fauci to tell us what was going on. So I think at critical moments in history, public radio is even more important. You know, I'm sure all of us can remember where we were at those particular moments, you know, 9/11 or the Oklahoma City bombing. And I often hear those memories in the voices of public radio hosts that told me what was happening. And so this is a time that it's even more important, I think, to support public radio than a random moment in the past when the world is changing so fast. There is so much going on. We need those voices. We need thoughtful consideration and discussion. And UPR brings that right into our homes every day, every hour. It's an amazing thing, deserving your support.
Here's how to support conversations like this one. You won't find anything like Access Utah anywhere but public radio. Commercial radio, commercial stations, they have to sell ads, of course, and it's short and sharp, right, to the programming. So longer considerations, in-depth news reporting, that's what you find at public radio. And if that's what you especially count on, we're counting on you to help support it. And that's the only way that it works, with your support. UPR.org. UPR.org is the place to go. UPR.org is our website. And you can look at our thank you gifts there as well. UPR.org. And thank you. We'll have another break. We'll be back with our last segment with Stephen Trimble.
Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. I represent the Political Center. Join us for Both Sides of the Aisle from KCPW, a weekly debate over politics, policy, and current issues facing the state of Utah, featuring voices representing the right, the center, and the left. Both Sides of the Aisle attempts to help you understand the important questions facing residents of this state while proving that Republicans and Democrats can sit in a small room and have a meaningful conversation. Tune in Thursday mornings at 10 here on Utah Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Steve Williams, host of Jazz Time here on Utah Public Radio. I hope you'll join me Sunday evenings for a journey through the world of jazz music, from ragtime to bop, from Havana to Logan, Utah. Tune in for a bit of history, commentary, the occasional interview, and of course, all that jazz. Jazz Time, Sunday evenings at 6 o'clock on Utah Public Radio.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest for the hour is Stephen Trimble, writer and photographer, talking to us from Torrey, near Capitol Reef National Park. Stephen Trimble, I want to spend, we have about 5 or 6 minutes left in the program, want to talk about how do we even talk to each other? It's an ongoing problem. And this piece in the Salt Lake Tribune is just from a couple of days ago, March 19th publication date. You say, I have one Donald Trump supporter in my blue progressive Facebook bubble. He's a devotee of full-throated Fox News Newsmax feed. He wants us all to believe in the endless stream of conspiracies about Hunter Biden, stolen election, Antifa infiltrators, the Capitol riot. You go on to say, I rarely respond to this friend's comments, which deeply frustrates him, but leaving him in the feed gives me a shred of hope. It gives you a shred of hope. How so?
Well, I was hoping that my Facebook friend would read my post, too, and that maybe these pieces that I was sharing on my Facebook from the New York Times and the Washington Post and NPR might make a dent, might, you know, make him a little bit questioning of those conspiracies that he believes in. And he literally, as far as I know, was the only person I had in my Facebook group who was a hardcore, you know, very, very far extreme Trump supporter who, when he would post a comment, you know, just completely rejected all the people that I think of as doing their very best to give us the best obtainable version of the truth. And this happened repeatedly over several years where occasionally he would pipe up and just lash out at things that I would post and say, this can't possibly be true, and then repeat the things that he was being told on Fox News. And other Facebook friends would message me privately and say, why don't you block him? You know, he's attacking you. He's filled with hate and divisiveness. And I kept thinking that there might be some usefulness in having him there. Occasionally, one of my other Facebook friends would respond to him. I just had to believe that there, you know, as you said, Tom, we've got to figure out a way to talk to each other. And this, we weren't really talking to each other, but at least we were being exposed to each other. And finally, in the course of the last several months, after Joe Biden won the election and after Trump tried to convince all his followers that the election was stolen, which it was not, this friend kept posting things, you know, over and over and over again that were basically a just a litany of stop the steal. And a few days before the inauguration, he finally got to saying, all I can say, Stephen, is you're in for a rude awakening in the next couple of weeks. Trump will be your president. He was convinced that Trump was going to continue. And I finally blocked him. I finally made that decision. And I did it not so much as a political statement. I just did it to reduce the amount of stress that would hit me when I opened up my Facebook page waiting for his attack. And yet he really wanted to talk. He wanted to debate, as he put it. That was the word he used. And as I thought about it and talked about it with friends, actually I had a friend give me this idea about Facebook not being anything like a neighborhood bar, and that you can't debate faith. My Trumpian friend believes in conspiracy in the way that he believes in his religion, I think. You know, it's a matter of faith. It's not logic. It's not rational. And you can't debate faith. And if I was sitting next to him at the neighborhood bar, as my friend pointed out, I could buy him a drink and try to find common ground. You know, we could talk about our mutual love of the Utah landscape or talk about sports. If it didn't work, I could move down a few seats. But on Facebook, that's not an option. And my conclusion was really, Facebook isn't the place for us to figure out how to talk to each other, because we're just kind of blasting at each other. Another friend said it's sort of like the old video game Space Invaders. You know, we're just trying to take a good shot and then retreat to our bubbles. You know, a long time ago, I was thinking about this, and it led to the last few lines of my book, Bargaining for Eden, where I talked about how we really have to find some common ground to have these conversations. You know, I need to go stump along the ditch line with those county commissioners from Garfield County I was talking about earlier, and talk about water in the desert and the coming drought and things that we all care about, and maybe that will lead to different kinds of decisions. We need to cook together and eat together and tell jokes, and I think there is common ground. That's where we have to begin if we're going to be able to talk to each other.
Yeah, that is hopeful. You have retained some hope. That's good. That's because these are can be depressing times. I guess it's more face to face than obviously Facebook, as you say, is not the answer if we want to unify or you know, understand each other, get away from blasting at each other. Well, we've reached almost to the end of our hour together, Stephen Trimble. So, do you have one last appeal for fellow listeners why they should give to UPR?
Sure, and it's been a delight to talk with you, Tom. Well, this is an appeal for Utah. It's an appeal for our home, and public radio connects us. Public radio goes out into those airwaves, and you can pull it in as you drive the long straightaways in the West Desert or through the canyons of the Canyon Country or over the top of the mountains. You know, it's with us everywhere. It's actually one of those things that does give us the common ground I was just talking about. And, you know, I've heard stories about truck drivers that got bored listening to right-wing talk radio and kind of landed on public radio by accident and eventually started listening and became fans. And we hope supporters and donors, too. So it's one of those things that is an incredible resource that we can tap into anywhere, whenever we want, and find great stories and people who touch us and move us and the information we need to be connected to the greater world. It's just one of my favorite things out there. And we take it for granted, but we all need to participate by showing up and giving whatever we can to support this resource that really does pull us together, not just in Utah, but really all over the country, all over the world now, when you can tap into to the live feed of UPR anywhere you are traveling and kind of touch home once again.
Well, we appreciate you being on with us. UPR.org is a place to go. Take care of that. And Stephen Trimble, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Tom. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
We'll talk on Earth Day. Thank you very much.
That's right.
Utah Public Radio is a statewide member-supported service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK.